Hello and welcome to another episode of the Critical Care Revision Aid Podcast. We hope these are proving useful for some of you. If you'd like to offer some constructive criticism or send us an idea for a topic to do, then please email us at feedback@ccrap.icu. That's feedback@ccrap.icu. Episode 10, Burns.
You are called to ED to assess a patient who has been brought in following a house fire with burn injuries. How can the severity of these burns be assessed?
Burn severity can be estimated by the size of the area affected or by the depth of burn. The presence of inhalational injury also increases the severity of the burn. The surface area of the burn can be estimated in several ways. The Lund-Browder chart is an age-specific chart which allows measurement of the burn surface area as a percentage of total body surface area. There are apps available which allow easy application of this tool. The Wallace Rule of Nines can also be used to give a rough estimate of burn area. Here, the body is divided into areas comprising 9% of total body surface area, and those affected are added together to give a total percentage. The use of the patient's palm size with adducted fingers to represent 1% of body surface area can also be helpful. Burn depth is classified as superficial, partial thickness, or full thickness. Superficial burns involve the epidermis only and are very painful. They will be dry with no blistering. Partial thickness burns involve the dermal layer and are either superficial or deep dermal. These areas will be red, edematous, and will blister. They will also be extremely painful. Full thickness burns are those which destroy all skin layers. They will be white, as capillary beds will be destroyed, and painless, as nociceptors will have been lost.
What features of the history and examination would make you suspicious of an inhalational injury?
Significant factors in the history include a fire in enclosed space and prolonged extraction time. On examination, facial burns, the presence of carbonaceous sputum, and evidence of singeing of the nasal or facial hair are signs of an inhalational injury. Additionally, and most concerningly, a patient with stridor or voice change is likely to have had a significant inhalational injury.
What are your initial management priorities? What formula should be used for your fluid resuscitation?
Management of a burns patient should follow an ABCDE approach using ATLS principles. Early intubation is indicated if there's suspicion of an inhalational injury. An uncut endotracheal tube should be used in case of swelling, and a large-sized tube is preferable to allow bronchoscopy if needed. There are also other indications for early intubation, including reduced conscious level, respiratory failure, or for appropriate analgesia or to facilitate the management of the burns. Regular arterial blood gases should be taken to look for ventilatory adequacy, but also for cyanide poisoning and for carbon monoxide poisoning. Burns patients should be treated as trauma patients. This is particularly important if there is any evidence of blast injury. When initiating airway management, C-spine control must be remembered. Lung protective ventilation is very important due to the risk of ARDS. Tidal volumes of 5 to 7 mL per kilo, optimally titrated PEEP, and FiO2 along with plateau pressures of less than 30 cm of water should be maintained. Cardiovascular fluid resuscitation is the mainstay. The resuscitative fluid requirements of a burns patient in the first 24 hours can be estimated using the Parkland formula. This describes giving 4 mL per kilo per percentage body surface area over 24 hours, with the first half of this delivered in 8 hours from burn time, not admission time, and the second half in the following 16 hours. This is only resuscitative fluid, so maintenance fluid requirements should be calculated on top of this. Analgesia is really important. Opioids may be useful. Ketamine is another helpful adjunct, but the patient may require general anaesthesia for adequate pain control. Burns patients become hypothermic easily, so temperature must be controlled. The environmental temperature should be increased along with high humidity to reduce temperature loss through evaporation. Patients may require early surgical management of the burns depending on circumstances. In circumferential burns, escharotomies may be needed urgently. Fasciotomies may also be needed quickly. Early debridement allows source control for the inflammatory response and reduces hypermetabolic state.
Does the Parkland formula over or underestimate the volume of fluid needed? How would you assess if your fluid resuscitation was accurate?
The Parkland formula overestimates the volume of fluid needed. Other markers to look at include the urine output and lactate, and fluid rates can be adjusted based on these. Other invasive monitoring may also be useful to add to the picture, such as invasive BP monitoring, CVP monitoring, or cardiac output monitoring.
Tell me about cyanide poisoning. How does it present and how is it diagnosed and treated?
Cyanide inhibits mitochondrial cytochrome oxidase, blocking oxidative phosphorylation and therefore leads to anaerobic respiration. It presents commonly with breathlessness, hypotension, vomiting, or loss of consciousness. There will be an unexplained metabolic acidosis and unexplained high venous saturations on blood gas analysis. A low arteriovenous saturation gradient will be seen as there is no oxygen extraction at the tissue level. Cyanide levels can be performed in the laboratory, but this is slow and results are unlikely to be available quickly enough to help with the diagnosis. The management of cyanide poisoning is supportive. Patients should be given 100% oxygen. They may need intubation to facilitate this. There are specific antidotes available, who all have disadvantages or significant side effects. Dicobalt edetate or sodium thiosulfate can all be used. The prognosis is reasonably good if symptoms are mild to moderate. It is recognised and treated promptly, but is very poor if in cardiorespiratory arrest. There is a reasonable risk of neurological sequelae in survivors.
And what about carbon monoxide poisoning?
Carbon monoxide has an affinity for hemoglobin which is 250 times that of oxygen. It therefore rapidly displaces O2 and is hard to shift from the hemoglobin molecules, reducing oxygen carrying capacity. It also causes a left shift of the hemoglobin-oxygen dissociation curve, reducing oxygen offloading. Both of these factors reduce tissue O2 delivery and therefore cause tissue hypoxia. Carbon monoxide also has a direct toxic effect on cytochrome oxidase, meaning that the oxygen which can be carried and extracted cannot be used efficiently. Carbon monoxide poisoning presents with nausea and vomiting. Patients can have neurological disturbance which ranges from mild confusion to coma. The classically described cherry red skin appearance is rare. Arterial blood gases show raised carboxyhemoglobin levels. Usually these are around 1%, although up to 10% can be normal in patients who smoke. Arterial oxygen concentrations will be normal, and oxygen saturations on the pulse oximeter will tend towards 100% due to the overlapping absorption spectra of carbon monoxide and oxygen. Carbon monoxide poisoning is managed by the administration of 100% oxygen. This will reduce carbon monoxide half-life from 4 hours to 1 hour and so enable recovery. The patient may need intubation and ventilation to allow this. Hyperbaric oxygen therapy can be considered in severe cases as this will reduce the half-life even further, but the practicalities of arranging this and the transfer times involved likely mean this will not end up being of benefit.